Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
This is a one-time voluntary opportunity for farmers as a whole to enroll up to 30 million new base acres based on their 2019 to 2023 planting history.
Washburn University tax law specialist Roger McOwen.
This starts with the 2026 crop year. So the 2025 ARC and PLC are going to be continued to be based on the producer's current base acres, but that increase starting with the 26 crop year. And there's a formula that's involved in terms of how many base acres are increased and then how the payments are going to be adjusted in accordance with that. But bottom line is, the way this works, for people to understand this, is if base acres go up, that means you've got more acres that are eligible for payments, and with the reference prices going up, that's going to put more cash in farmers' pockets.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
China's government threatening to block a proposed $23 billion deal that would transfer ownership of dozens of ports, including two at the Panama Canal, from Hong Kong-based CK Hutchison to Western investors, unless Chinese shipping giant COSCO is granted a stake. Wall Street Journal reports that state-owned COSCO seeking to become an equal partner alongside BlackRock and Mediterranean Shipping Company, who reached a preliminary agreement back in March to acquire Global Ports portfolio of Hutchison. The deal includes 43 ports in 23 countries. Now, sources indicate all parties are now open to COSCO's participation to avoid Chinese government interference. But the deal drawing scrutiny from President Donald Trump, who has opposed Chinese control of Panama Canal operations. Trump previously threatened to take over the canal, calling it vital to U.S. interest, White House not issuing a formal response. Panama Canal remains a critical trade corridor, particularly for U.S. ag. According to American Farm Bureau Federation, Canal handles 72% of cargo headed to or from the U.S. It includes 18% of U.S. corn exports, 32% of U.S. soybeans, and over 90% of sorghum exports. Ongoing drought has reduced capacity, increasing congestion and cost. Roughly 10,000 ships transit the canal annually. That accounts for 2.5% of global maritime trade. Well, farm bankruptcies are rising this year, signaling a return to the financial pressures that plagued producers before the pandemic. That's according to economists with the University of Arkansas System Division of Ag. Between April 1 of 2024 and March 31st of this year, 259 Chapter 12 farm bankruptcies filed in the U.S. First quarter filings this year already outpacing the same period last year. Now, Chapter 12 of the Federal Bankruptcy Code allows family farmers to restructure debt and avoid liquidation, unlike Chapter 7. The increase in filings reflects a mix of challenges facing producers. It includes lower commodity prices, persistently high input cost, and tighter credit availability. Extension economist Ryan Loy said data reflects conditions last seen in 2018 and 2019. Now, the government of Bangladesh has signed a five-year agreement to purchase 700,000 metric tons of U.S. wheat every year. It secures a consistent role for American wheat in the country's food security planning. Deal formalized in a MOU, or Memorandum of Understanding, signed with the U.S. Wheat Associates during a ceremony held July 20th. The agreement aims to deepen trade ties with the U.S. and address the current trade imbalance between the two nations. Now, Bangladesh has been a periodic buyer of U.S. wheat, importing as much as 450,000 metric tons back in 2019-2020. But their most recent purchase, 150,000 metric tons of hard red spring wheat in 23-24. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
I think there's three or four of these, of course, on the business side of things.
Roger McCohen is a tax law specialist with Washburn University, looking into what's in the Big Beautiful Bill or Big Beautiful Act for ag.
The depreciation provisions are huge. We get restored 100% bonus, first year bonus depreciation, effective for qualified assets placed in service on or after January 19 of this year. And that is huge in terms of asset purchases and farm machinery manufacturers, those types of things. That's really going to drive and stimulate more asset purchases. And that would apply to a lot of farm assets. It applies to property that has a 20-year maker's life or less. And accompanying with that, we got an increase in the Section 179 write-off. The off-the-top allowance now goes to $2.5 million, and the phase-in kicks in at $4 million of qualified purchases. So once I have enough qualified purchases to get over the $4 million amount, I lose a dollar of that $2.5 million write-off for every dollar I'm above $4 million in my purchases. Again, big, big deal for farmers. Another one that's huge out there is the qualified business income deduction. That's a 20% deduction off your business income. And so for a farmer, let's say they have $300,000 of farm income, that's a $60,000 deduction right there. So you put those three together, those are really big for many farmers that are out there. And of course, what was retained, it wasn't going to sunset, but what we had put in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act starting in 2018 was a 21% corporate tax rate, and that stays. So we have a really good tax structure right now for business, and you're seeing this reflected in the stock market. We're sitting at all-time highs on the stock market right now. We've got the trade numbers coming in from tariffs, and that has exceeded all the economists' gloomy forecasts about that. Now, I was one in the past, and it's in my writings that said this would not be inflationary, and it has indeed not been inflationary. So we got a pretty good business setting for our farmers, and then in the OBBBA, we've got a farm bill.
Now, he also reminds us it's important to pay attention to changes and details.
The key point here is that the Congress has really strengthened the safety net by increasing those reference prices, by giving them this year the hire of ARC and PLC, and by some changes with respect to crop insurance, too, which we didn't talk about, but they've made some changes there, and an important change in the adjusted gross income computation. Now machinery gains will count as farm income, and that is a very important change. I was in a group of about four of us that had been pushing for a number of years on FSA to get that done, and they had refused. Well, Congress is now forcing their hand, and that's important because once you clear a 75% threshold with 75% or more of your adjusted gross income coming from farming income, then there's a couple of other limitations that drop off. And that's going to be very big because now a lot of farmers will have income from the trading of farm equipment, which is now treated as a sale on Form 4797 under TCJA. So they've corrected that problem. But bottom line, safety net has been enhanced, and this is a lot of dollars going into the sector, probably somewhere between $50 and $60 billion. Have been specifically tied to that farm safety net, and that's a big deal.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Stock prices have continued to march upward. Particularly, we're seeing kind of that shift in kind of where that price momentum is actually happening, depending upon kind of the weight of cattle.
Elliot Dennis, University of Nebraska at Lincoln Livestock Economist.
At least in Nebraska right now, we're seeing a lot of kind of steady upward movement in the 7-8 weights for Nebraska. We do see some upward movements in for the 5-6 weights, but the percentage price increase has been most notable for 7-8 weights. Really just kind of continuing to show at least preferences in the northern plains for kind of cattle that are feedlot ready, and there's a lot of reasons why we're placing heavier cattle, shorter days on feed, get them throughout, get them out the door quicker. And that's really for Nebraska. When we look across the different regions, Nebraska is one of the few regions that's kind of continued to march kind of steady upward. All the other regions have kind of, I would say, kind of leveled out a little bit. There hasn't been kind of this strong trend. Everything's kind of you know, really plateaued over the last several weeks. And these are weekly averages. So, of course, individual sale barns are going to vary and individual lots, even within a sale barn for individual producers. But as these prices and some of the things that we're talking about now is, as those prices have kind of continued to march upward, what does this kind of really mean for rebuilding the herd and potential movements into feedlots early? Kind of drawing back from the lessons that we learned in 2013 and 2014, you know, really making wise decisions when we're buying replacement animals now. We had a huge run-up in calf prices, and we're buying heifers or cows, and just kind of really sitting down and penciling the business decision out of how many cows or how many feeder cattle is it going to take to really pay off this cow or heifer that I'm buying, and recognizing kind of national averages of kind of retention in the herd of 5 to 7 years. And so just making sure if we're making those purchases now to try to capture what some people believe kind of continue a rising market, that we know kind of what has to go right in the market and what could potentially go wrong.
And is now the time to hold heifers back?
What I would suggest is that if you're interested in that, Nebraska has a heifer replacement cost calculator that you can go in there, and we put kind of some general projections out there. You can go ahead and adjust it by how long you think they're going to be in the herd, where you think price is going to go at. And of course, K-State also has their beef cow replacement cost calculator as well. Really kind of putting out what you think those expectations are, because recognizing that that cow that stays in your herd pays itself off over time with really variable feeder cattle prices. So while we might make the decision to capture, you know, feeder cattle prices now, you know, some of those cows that are being culled today were purchased back in 2014. It took that long to pay them off.
What are we seeing for live cattle?
Live cattle was kind of humdrum a lot this week. I mean, most of the markets are trading sideways. I think a lot of people are still trying to figure out kind of where we go with beef demand after the 4th of July. This is kind of the last push towards Labor Day. A lot of places are going to start to purchase kind of their supplies. And so it will give some support for where we think the cattle market's going to go in August. But I think a lot of people are looking towards, you know, can we continue strong during the summer? And really, what does this consumer demand look like for beef products that continue to be at record highs? And really, I'd say continue to spy a lot of market expectations of, you know, how much are people willing to pay for beef.
Has cutout also been sideways?
Hey, cutout has backed off a little bit this week. And most of that's been in the rib and loins, which has kind of given some people some hesitancy of kind of the markets can continue to show kind of momentum moving upward and really give, I'd say, credibility to why we should be paying these high prices for them. So I think there's this week, there's been some downward pressure to try to push the market lower because of just kind of what the cutout's doing and being passed along the supply chain.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Several major developments have taken place when it comes to trade. This includes delays of implementation of country-specific tariffs, as well as new threats of tariffs against the European Union, Mexico, and Brazil. Dave Salmonson, Senior Director of Government Affairs for the American Farm Bureau Federation, says the new deadline to circle on the calendar is August 1st.
The president announced that about a week ago, giving many countries more time to negotiate deals with the U.S. to lower tariffs. And certainly in agriculture, we hope to reduce barriers and increase our opportunities to export our products.
Salmonson says farmers could face the brunt of impacts if tariffs are implemented.
I think you'd get a couple of impacts. One, their products coming in here, of course, would be more expensive. Some of these tariffs from the 20 to 30% or higher. Things that farmers use, inputs that come from overseas, would definitely become pricier. If tariffs go into effect, countries will respond. Either they retaliate with their own tariffs on us, or they may look elsewhere to buy.
Salmonson said it's still too early to know how trading partners will react.
We've seen in the past, China put on some higher tariffs. They ended up about 10% more. Other countries don't have a big history of retaliating. Even though they get higher tariffs, they don't usually put higher tariffs on what they get from us. But then again, they may look to purchase elsewhere if they can find it.
While Congress's One Big Beautiful Bill budget package included approximately $66 billion in investment in key farm programs, there is still work to be done. Brian Glenn, Director of Government Affairs with the American Farm Bureau Federation, said a key focus was on improving risk management programs.
About $60 billion of that investment was put towards modernizing farm safety net programs. These modernizations include extending key commodity support programs through the 2031 crop year. The bill also raises statutory reference prices for major covered commodities. It expanded premium support for beginning farmers and ranchers.
Despite those wins, Glenn said there are still several critical farm programs that need updating through a new farm bill.
Some of those programs include reauthorization and funding for the Conservation Reserve Program, also support for rural broadband programs in the rural development title, and support for additional research and extension programs. And there's also opportunity to make important policy updates, such as securing a fix to Proposition 12.
He said Congress is working on the next steps in the Farm Bill process right now.
Chairman G.T. Thompson of the House Agriculture Committee is drafting a Farm Bill that addresses those remaining Farm Bill programs. They're doing that as we speak. Both the House and Senate Agriculture Committees are currently conducting hearings on important policy priorities, and they're looking to move the bill this fall.
Chad Smith, Washington.
Roger McCohen is a tax law specialist with Washburn University.
These provisions are generally good through 2031, and then it'll change. So we've got some time here to work with this. So it's not like we're up against a one-year authorization, and we're going to do that and then reauthorize it again. This is policy that's set for a period of time now. So that's pretty good. From a planning standpoint, I think this helps. And as I talk to CPAs and attorneys that represent farm clients, this really helps the planning horizon because we've got the policy set in place that's going to be here for a while. It would take an act of Congress to change it, and of course, they can always do that. But once this gets in place like this, they're not going to change it. So we know where we're headed from a farm policy standpoint for a number of years.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
So a lot of people have been talking about kind of droughts, and what we kind of see from the drought monitor is that, yeah, there is drought occurring.
Elliot Dennis is a livestock economist at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. So we talk about drought, but how it also affects rebuilding the cow herd.
But when we look at kind of national averages and even by regions, there isn't a huge difference between really what we've experienced this year and kind of the past year that's been rating poor and very poor compared to what we've seen in kind of years past. Really, the exception there is the mountain region, which has tended to be a larger share of the total pasture has been rating poor and very poor. Once again, these are regional averages within states and within even within counties, at least particularly here in Nebraska. You have some counties that have been getting a lot of rain, and then you go one county over and it's you know, very dry. So I don't see kind of the rain conditions being a primary driver to why we should retain or not retain or kind of continue to capture market trends. And so really, I think we should be looking at kind of calf prices, what our feed resources are at, and whether we think there's opportunities to capture more value by putting on weight. And of course, always making that as a business decision with the value of gain.
Now, on the topic of trade, it's not always about just tariffs. Dennis explains.
Another report that was recently released from the Center for Ag Profitability, I'm the co-author on that, is really looking at these trade negotiations and particularly these effects that President Trump has been talking about as what we call non-tariff merit measures. And really what you think of these are is like they're not a tax, but they prevent trade from occurring. And so one of the things that we focus on there is what we call maximum residue limits. So these are quantities of antimicrobials that can be in meat products or byproducts in order for trade to occur. There is a national standard, what's called Codex, which is international kind of guidelines. This is by species, by product, by drug. But countries can set their own residue limits. And this is kind of gets on to what a little bit of what President Trump has been saying about, other countries have been setting these high non-tariff measures that have prevented beef from from coming in. And what we show there is that, in fact, that does the case for a lot of the protein products that we export. So we look at what the U.S.'s non-tariff measures or these MRLs are, and we look at our primary trading partners, and we show that the U.S. is most lax out of all the trading partners for these primary protein products, which means that people can be using antimicrobials at a greater rate in countries that are exporting to the United States compared to if we are exporting to, let's say, Japan, we have to have more judicious use in our antimicrobials. So ultimately what that means is that it raises our cost of production in the United States compared to the other location. So these are real. They're supposed to be set by science-based standards, but we all know there's a little bit of politics involved in kind of science-based standards. And so the way these are set can be really a terms of negotiation. So just something that we think people would be interested in, and definitely give some credit or some credence to kind of these arguments that non-tariff measures are an impact and potentially trade hindrance even for the beef complex.
Elliot Dennis, University of Nebraska at Lincoln. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
So I use a very simple definition when it comes to, well, how do you define what a leader is? And so in my mind, a leader has to have a team or a group or some sort of a following, right?
Kansas State beef cattle specialist Justin Wagner.
A long time ago, a pretty wise person gave me a definition of leadership. And he said, you know, if you look behind you and there's no one behind you, you're not a leader. You're just out for a walk. And so I think that gives us a pretty vivid picture, paints a certainly a mental picture of what a leader is or what a leader is not, and what the difference is that you know, having that team or that following, you know, that group of individuals that you're responsible for. I think that is really one of the things that defines a leader, right? And then even within leaders, you know, I think it's important to recognize, right, there's, we have to think of formal leaders, right? Within a group, like there is a department head. We also have informal leaders, you know, those that don't necessarily wear the title. And so I think it's always important when we talk about leaders and leadership to recognize that they do come in different types, right? We can have those that have the formal title, but oftentimes within a group of people, there's that informal leader who's very influential, that's very much leading that group of individuals. And, you know, whether that's a thought leader or leading them towards a mission or whatever that mean, an objective that's down the road, I think that's an important thing to recognize, is those different types of leaders that are out there.
What are some characteristics?
There's a high value on trust, right? And so I like the performance versus trust matrix, because I think it really speaks to the fact that there's a lot more to leadership than we often think there is. Some of those are intrinsic. And so, you know, how do we build trust? And so there's some interesting work that was, you know, actually done in psychology in the military fairly recently. It talks about how we build institutional trust really within the context of the military. And so what they came back to, this is the work of Dr. Patrick Sweeney. So if you want to reference that, that's out there. And he basically came up with three C's in terms of building institutional trust. And so it comes down to competency, character, and caring. In a good leader, essentially, we're looking for someone that, you know, has the necessary skills. They've got to be competent in whatever that skill set is. You know, the third part is character. You know, they need to be a good person, right? It kind of speaks to that trustworthiness. Do they have some integrity? Do they have all of those things that we look for? Are they a good person, right? Do they have my back? As if I'm a team member, that's something that's going to be important to me. And the third one is caring. Right. They have to have empathy. You know, it's not about meeting all of the needs of those people, but, you know, am I going to ask them to do something that I wouldn't do? You know, exactly. Do I care about my people? I want to look after that we versus me attitude in a leader. And so as we think about building trust, as we think about effective leaders, I think those three C's, there's really some things to be gleaned from those in terms of what's important as we look for leaders, you know, across in the business world, academia, you know, community leaders, et cetera. And I think when you come back to some of those things, those are really some important core criteria, if you will.
Takes a little emotional IQ.
You got to be able to read people, right? Know where people are at and really kind of ask them questions or things that show that you care, right? Demonstrate that. So I think there's that social and emotional intelligence of, you know, really just beginning to understand people. I think the other thing that for myself, as I think about leaders and what's important to me and what I look for in leader, you know, integrity. That's a big thing, you know. Are they going to do the right thing, even if it hurts them, right? do the right thing. You know, who are you when nobody's looking? That's how we define it in the Wagner household. So I'll share that. You know, who are you when no one's looking? And we've talked about this before, that we versus me, right? I think in good leaders, you know, it's, you know, we can call it servant leadership. You know, we can loosely define it as the we versus me. You know, it takes a team. If my team is successful, then I'm successful. And I think that's an important criteria to come back to that I often, when I look at leaders or I start to think about selecting people for leadership roles, those are the kind of things that I'm going to look for.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
We have easily passed the halfway mark on corn reaching the silking stage. The national number on July 20th is 56%. Although for the first time, we have fallen behind the five-year average, which is 58%. Last year, we were also at 58%. Looking at the 18 major production states, only one is more at least 10 percentage points behind the five-year average. That is Minnesota, 44% silking versus the five-year average of 54%. Everybody else within that 10 percentage point range.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey.
Meanwhile, corn reaching the dough stage, 14% on July 20th. That's 2 points ahead of the five-year average of 12%, but a little behind last year's 16%. Mainly in the south, we're seeing that progress a little faster. It's been a little warmer there. And so we see numbers like North Carolina, 71% dough stage. Five-year average is 48%. We're also 10 points ahead of the five-year average in Texas.